You are listening to Coffee Before Pants. Greetings and welcome to another episode of Coffee Before Pants, the weekly podcast for writers, readers, raconteurs, and roustabouts. This is the 20th episode of the podcast. All right, here's the question. Do you recommend books to others? When you really like a book, do you have to tell everybody about it? Do you like it when someone gives you an unsolicited reading recommendation? Do you actually read the books others have recommended, or do you just somehow avoid reading the book altogether? I personally like talking about the books I read. I mean, that's one of the biggest points to this podcast, although I do like talking about literary history as well. Well, the recommendation of books is the subject for this week's podcast. And in case you are wondering, I, for some reason, resist reading books that others recommend. I'm not sure why, really. Because of this, I will understand if none of my book recommendations are heeded. Perhaps it is an independent spirit that causes us to balk at someone else's recommendations. I always am looking for something new to read. Yet when someone else recommends a book, I'm not sure what happens in my brain. Maybe it's the whole, well, it wasn't my idea thing. Nevertheless, I'm here this week to tell you about authors I always recommend to others, whether they are read or not. But before we explore that and other things only hinted at, it's time for Coffee with Culture, survey of this week in the history of literature, film, TV, and music. April 14, 1828, Noah Webster published his two-volume dictionary containing 70,000 total words. He set the price at $20 for a full set, but it sold poorly. Once he reduced the price to $15, sales picked up, eventually leading to the Webster series becoming a trademark name in dictionaries. April 14, 1976, poet Jericho Brown was born in Shreveport, Louisiana. Brown won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 2020. April 15, 1802, William Wordsworth and his sister Dorothy went for a stroll in the Lake District and saw a field of daffodils. Upon his arrival at home, he penned one of his most famous poems, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud. April 16, 1816, Lord Byron signed a deed of separation dissolving his marriage to his wife of 1 year. Lady Byron, a religious prodigy, was an odd match for the flamboyant and agnostic poet. However, her letters implied that she hoped to reform him and bring him to God. Their 1 year of marriage was tumultuous. As Lord Byron grew in financial debt, drank heavily, and engaged in numerous affairs. After the birth of their daughter, Ada, Lady Byron moved in with her parents. She sought divorce, which Byron refused, until she documented her reasons for seeking separation, including Byron's homosexual affairs as well as an incestuous relationship with his half-sister. Lord Byron agreed and emigrated to the Mediterranean, never seeing his wife or daughter again. April 16, 1932, the short film The Music Box was released on this day in the United States, starring Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy. The film, which depicts the pair attempting to move a piano up a long flight of steps, won the first Academy Award for Best Live Action Short in Comedy in 1932. In 1997, it was selected for preservation in the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being, quote, culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant, end quote. The film is widely seen as the most iconic Laurel and Hardy short, with the featured stairs becoming a popular tourist attraction. April 16, 2017, a world record is for gathering of Charlie Chaplin lookalikes, 662 at Manoir de Bonn Chaplin Museum in Vevey, Switzerland. According to Chaplin legend, somewhere between 1915 and 1921, Charlie Chaplin himself decided to enter a Chaplin look-alike contest and lost badly. He came in 20th, posing as himself. April 17, 1397, according to scholars, this day is the date that Geoffrey Chaucer's characters in the Canterbury Tales began their journey to the shrine of St. Thomas Becket. April 17, 1885, playwright and novelist Thornton Wilder was born in Madison, Wisconsin. I did not know that. Wilder won 3 Pulitzer Prizes in his lifetime for his plays Our Town, The Skin of Our Teeth, and for his novel, The Bridge of San Luis Rey. April 18, 1983, novelist Alice Walker won the Pulitzer Prize for her novel, The Color Purple. Walker was the first Black woman to win the prestigious award. And another Lord Byron story. April 19, 1824, poet Lord Byron died at the age of 36. In his later years, Byron had become a passionate soldier fighting for Greek freedom from the Ottoman Empire. Before Byron's first military excursion, however, he grew ill and contracted sepsis. He died in Missolonghi, and the Greeks gave him a hero's funeral. April 19, 1927, actress Mae West, found guilty of, quote, obscenity and corrupting the morals of youth, end quote, in a New York stage play entitled Sex. She is sentenced to 10 days in prison and fined $500. The resulting publicity launches her Hollywood career. April 19, 1935, Bride of Frankenstein, horror film classic and sequel to Frankenstein, starring Boris Karloff and Elsa Lancaster, is released. Fans and critics alike agree that this film is superior to the original, as well as all of the rest of the Universal Frankenstein franchise. I, of course, love them all. April 20th, 1611, Shakespeare's Macbeth was performed at Globe Theatre in London for the very first time. Most scholars believe Macbeth was written to reflect the new English king, James I, honoring his Scottish heritage. April 20th, 1977, Annie Hall, directed by Woody Allen and starring Woody Allen, Diane Keaton, and Tony Roberts, as well as many others, is released. The film has several cameos, including Truman Capote. Look, it's the winner of the Truman Capote look-alike contest. Marshall McLuhan in one of the funniest scenes, and Jeff Goldblum. Look for the guy on the phone at Tony Lacey's, played by Paul Simon, party, calling his guru because he forgot his mantra. Okay, on to a list of authors I tend to recommend to others. I'll start with the fiction authors, and then nonfiction will be a different episode. As an aside, personally, I try to alternate between fiction and nonfiction, book by book. It doesn't always happen. Sometimes I will find an author I really like and want to read more without having to wait. Then again, that's me. I don't hold myself to this rule all the time. I also believe that enjoying what you read is more important than restrictions on what you read or in what order. It's also important to know that you are not obligated to read a book that you are not enjoying. Enjoying what you read is more than half the fun. The first author, one of my favorites, I say that with a lot of authors, Haruki Murakami is the author of The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle, Kafka on the Shore, Colorless Sukuru and Tozaki and His Years of Pilgrimage, and Hard-Boiled Wonderland and the End of the World. He's a Japanese writer whose novels, essays, and short stories have been bestsellers in Japan. His work has been translated into 50 languages and having sold millions of copies outside Japan. He has received numerous awards for his work, including the Gunzo Prize for New Writers, the World Fantasy Award, the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award, and the Franz Kafka Prize. The first book I read by Murakami was The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. It's a fairly long book at 607 pages. However, Murakami keeps the reader engaged and you forget the book is as long as it is. My favorite so far, though, is Kafka on the Shore, an equally engaging story and slightly shorter. Murakami's stories have elements of magical realism, the human struggle with everyday life, and a healthy dose of pathos. He's definitely in my top five of fiction authors. And he's another one that I want to read everything that he's written. Shane Jones is another author I thoroughly enjoy. He's the author of The Light Boxes, which I have mentioned in previous podcasts, as well as Daniel Fights a Hurricane and The Crystal Eaters. He was born in Albany, New York. He graduated from SUNY Buffalo in 2004 with a Bachelor's in Arts in English. As of May 2015, Jones is represented by the literary agency Dunnow, Carlson & Lerner. He was a student in Lydia Davis's fiction workshop taught by, at the NYS Writers Institute. I enjoyed all three of the books mentioned. They are weird and surreal, although written in a literary style that makes them not too difficult to read. I have a confession. I'm not the biggest fantasy reader. I do occasionally like the steampunk stories, and I have read most of the Robert E. Howard Conan stories that was back in high school. Neil Gaiman, however, was an exception, or is an exception, and I love reading Neil Gaiman. He is a prolific writer. He was born in Hampshire, United Kingdom, but moved to the United States in 1992. He currently lives near Minneapolis with his wife, musician Amanda Palmer. He's the author of Neverwhere, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, American Gods, Trigger Warning, which is a collection of short stories. His literary influences include H.P. Lovecraft, James Branch Cabell, Edgar Allan Poe, Michael Moorcock, V.K. Chesterton, among others. My first exposure to Neil Gaiman was the comic book graphic novel of The Sandman. The first book I read by Gaiman, however, was Neverwhere, also the book I usually recommend to others. I became so engrossed in the story that I was oblivious when I came to the end of the book. I came to the last page, and I needed more. I was almost ready to cry. I just wanted the story to not end. Isn't that the sign? Isn't that one of the signs of a good book? I also recommend American Gods. Just skip the television series. And although it's a kid's book, another favorite is The Day I Swapped My Dad for Two Goldfish, illustrated by Dave McKean. And here's another writer that, like I said, I don't usually read fiction. This is would be considered speculative fiction. But Kevin Brockmeyer is just an amazing writer. Brockmeyer was born in Hialeah, Florida, and raised in Little Rock, Arkansas. He's a graduate of Parkview Arts and Science Magnet High School and Southwest Missouri State University. He taught at the Iowa Writers Workshop, where he received his Master's of Fine Arts in 1997 and lives in Little Rock. His short stories have been printed in numerous publications, and he has published two collections of stories, two children's novels, and two fantasy novels. Brockmeyer has won three O. Henry Prizes, the Chicago Tribune's Nelson Algren Award for Short Fiction, the Italo Calvino Short Fiction Award, the Booker Worthen Literary Prize, and the Porter Fund Literary Prize. These are pretty prestigious prizes, from what I know. Although I've only read two novels by Kevin Brockmeyer, at this point I plan on reading everything I can get my hands on, the two collections of short stories specifically. His writing style is empathetic. His descriptions make it easy to see exactly what or who he is describing. His powers of description are just astounding. Although his novels have been described as speculative fiction, as I mentioned, to pigeonhole Brockmeyer would be an error of judgment. His work transcends labels, pigeonholes, categories. The novels I have read, the two novels mentioned, A Brief History of the Dead, to give you a hint towards the plot without giving too much away, Brockmeyer quotes James Lowen's Lies My Teachers Told Me at the beginning of the book. The quote describes the belief of many African tribes that humans can be divided into three categories: those still alive on Earth, the recently departed, Sasha, and the dead, Zamani. When people die, they are Sasha, while people are still alive who remember them. When the last person remembering them dies, they go to the Zamani and are then revered and recalled by name only. Are you intrigued? And then there is Brockmeyer's novel, The Illumination. And wow, what a story he tells. It asks the question, what if our pain and injuries were the most beautiful thing about us? It describes a universe in which human pain is expressed as an illumination, so that one's wounds glow luminescent. I found it a very engaging story. I look forward to reading more of Brockmeyer's fiction. It is safe to say that most people, or a lot of people, know or know of Ray Bradbury. If you don't, well, acquaint yourself with this wonderful writer. Born in 1920 in Waukegan, Illinois, Bradbury moved with his family to Los Angeles at the age of 14. After graduating high school, he entered his formal education and found work selling newspapers. In 1943, he began his career as a writer. He was a prolific writer, authoring stories of science fiction, speculative fiction, horror, and even detective stories. His books are too numerous to list, but if you want a good start, read Fahrenheit 451, a very topical story at this, still topical. October Country, or otherwise known as Dark Carnival, which was the original title. The Illustrated Man, or The Martian Chronicles. I don't have any favorites, really. I like them all. My first exposure to Ray Bradbury, I owe to two of my junior high school teachers. My science teacher, Stuart Davis, read us the time travel story, A Sound of Thunder, which was the start of my Ray Bradbury reading. And Steve Lather, our social studies teacher, showed a documentary about Ray Bradbury in class. The last time I looked, the documentary, filmed in 1963, is available on YouTube. I will post a link in the episode description. I want to say I am grateful to both Mr. Davis and Mr. Lather for this introduction to Ray Bradbury. On a personal note, a few years ago, Valerie and I went to Chicago's American Writers Museum, where there was a Ray Bradbury exhibit. In part of the exhibit, they had what I assume was Bradbury's first typewriter, or at least one of his first typewriters, a 1940s Royal. An adjacent placard encouraged visitors to sit down and type. I don't remember what I typed, but there was a sense of awe. Then again, the whole museum felt like church. You may have noticed the authors highlighted on this episode are writers of fiction. Trust me, I'll be back at a later date, as I said before, with nonfiction author recommendations. There are definitely so many more fiction writers than I could recommend. In fact, I plan on posting a reading list hoping not to be too conceited. A reading list on coffeebeforepants.com in the near future. This is a short episode, I believe. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, please comment in the comments section, or sneak up on the like button from behind and tap it on the shoulder. And if you would like to contribute to support this podcast, you can do so on Patreon or Ko-fi. I also have an Etsy shop with lots of merchandise like t-shirts, coffee mugs, and tote bags. The links to all three will be posted on the episode information. Before I go, it's time once again for the poem of the week. This week is For the Union Dead by Robert Lowell. For the Union Dead by Robert Lowell. The old South Boston Aquarium stands in a Sahara of snow now. Its broken windows are boarded. The bronze weathervane cod has lost half its scales. The airy tanks are dry. Once my nose crawled like a snail on the glass, my hand tingled to burst the bubbles drifting from the noses of the cowed, compliant fish. My hand draws back. I often sigh still for the dark, downward, and vegetating kingdom of the fish and reptile. One morning last March, I pressed against the new barbed and galvanized fence on the Boston Common. Behind their cage, yellow dinosaurs, steam shovels, were grunting as they cropped up tons of mush and grass to gouge their underworld garage. Parking spaces luxuriate like civic sand piles in the heart of Boston. A girdle of orange, Puritan pumpkin-colored girders braces the tingling state house, shaking over the excavation as it faces Colonel Shaw and his bell-cheeked Negro infantry on St. Gaudens shaking Civil War relief propped up by a plank splint against the garage's earthquake. 2 months after marching through Boston, half the regiment was dead. At the dedication, William James could almost hear the bronze Negroes breathe. Their monument sticks like a fishbone in the city's throat. Its colonel is as lean as a compass needle. He was an angry, wren-like vigilance, a greyhound gentle hotness. He seems to wince at pleasure and suffocate for privacy. He is out of bounds now. He rejoices in man's lovely, peculiar power to choose life and die. When he leads his black soldiers to death, he cannot bend his back. On 1,000 small-town New England greens, the old white churches hold their air of sparse, sincere rebellion. Frayed flags quilt the graveyards of the Grand Army of the Republic. The stone statues of the abstract Union soldier grow slimmer and younger each year. They doze over muskets and muse through their sideburns. Shaw's father wanted no monument except the ditch where his son's body was thrown and lost with his, quote, niggers. The ditch is nearer. There are no statues for the last war here. On Boylston Street, a commercial photograph shows Hiroshima boiling over a Mosler safe, the rock of ages that survived the blast. Space is nearer. When I crouch to my television set, the drained faces of Negro schoolchildren rise like balloons. Colonel Shaw is riding on his bubble. He waits for the blessed break. The aquarium is gone. Everywhere, giant finned cars nose forward like fish. A savage servility slides by on grease. Again, thank you for listening. This is the end of the show. It's time to wrap things up. I hope you have a good week, and I hope you find a lot of good books to read, even if they're not the ones I recommended.
Java jive and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the Java and me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
Boy,
I love Java, sweet and hot. Whoops, Mr. Moto, I'm a coffee pot. Shoot me the pot and I'll pour me a shot. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
You have been listening to Coffee Before Pants, a production of Irwin Allen Studios.